welcome to the Managing Violence Podcast, the internet's leading free resource on violence prevention, threat assessment, personal security, and self-protection, brought to you by R2S Violence Prevention. We are hashtag for the protectors. I'm your host, Joe Saunders. Welcome once again to the Managing Violence Podcast. We are back after a little bit of a break while I was over in Europe and doing all sorts of cool stuff. I will advise, guys, unfortunately, over the next couple of months, we might be a little bit more ad hoc. Things are picking up in terms of the business world, and that just means that I might have a little bit more limited bandwidth. But for the episodes we do put out, they are going to be spectacular, as you would expect, and today is no different. I'm a little bit under the weather, so we're going to get straight into the episode that is pre-recorded with Dr. Mary Beth Jenke. She is a former Secret Service agent. She is a former high-risk, high-profile protection agent, and now also a clinical psychologist, adjunct professor of psychology. She has an awful lot to teach us, and I can't wait to give you the interview with Dr. Mary Beth. Here we go. All right, I'm joined here on the Managing Violence Podcast by Dr. Mary Beth Jenke. Mary Beth, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh my God, thank you so much for having me, Joe. I'm super excited to talk today.
It's an interview I've been really looking forward to doing for quite a while. I found your book maybe a year ago or so. It was definitely during the pandemic. It came up on one of the executive protection groups that I was part of. I picked it up. It was a cracking read. It's called The Protector. We'll probably reference it several times throughout the show, but if you're already listening and you want to go pick it up, go do that. But it's a fantastic story of your journey through the Secret Service, through high-level executive protection and VIP protection in some places where people need protecting. And even more fascinating into your role now as a clinical psychologist and forensic psychologist. So I won't try and summarize your story. I would like it if perhaps you could kind of walk us through who you are and how you got to where you are.
Yeah, so I'm from the United States, because I know, you know, obviously you have an expansive listenership. And I was a United States Secret Service agent, and which is different from the CIA, which is different from the FBI. You know, we protect the president, we have investigative responsibilities. That was a short-lived career. It was about 13 months. And I always say you have to read the book to find out why. And that just tossed me right into, sort of by chance, but into the world of private executive protection internationally, as well as private investigation. And as you said, I worked in some shitholes. You put it much more diplomatically. I worked in places like Port-au-Prince, Haiti, Lima, Peru, and Bogota, Colombia, all when they were pretty dangerous. Bogota at the time was considered the kidnap capital of the world. I don't even know if Haiti's any different. I would suspect it's still, you know, the least appealing of the Western countries. And, you know, at the time in Lima, Peru, the Sendero Luminoso, the Shining Path, was very prominent and bombing all sorts of U.S. companies because they felt that we were doing things that we weren't necessarily. But like when I was there about a block away, they bombed a hotel because we were there for I was there protecting people that were doing an election mission, observation mission, and they didn't want us there. But it's all to say that I also, on the other side of that coin, worked very chic, foofy jobs, meaning like private planes and wealthy people and great restaurants and great hotels. And, you know, some of the nicest places I've eaten and stayed have been through some of those jobs. And so, you know, they were people that were in need of protection, but just a different side of the coin from, say, government work and contractor work that was, you know, government based. That they don't quite give you that level of per diem. And so in between there, after one job in the field that kind of burnt me out a little bit, I ended up going back for my master's in forensic psychology. So I was about 10 years out of undergraduate studies. And then about 20 years out of undergraduate studies, I went back for my doctorate. So I really have had my doctorate for just about 12 years.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah, so I went back real late. I mean, that was really challenging going back in my 40s.
Yeah. Well, I'm sitting here doing my master's now, 10 years after undergrad. So yeah, I'm kind of on the same
You
trajectory.
get it. The brain isn't working quite as well as it did 10 years ago.
Yeah, well, I don't stress about things as much as I used to though. So I don't know. Maybe
Yeah.
the life experience helps.
Yeah.
So what sort of time frame were you in South America? What years are we talking?
Yeah, so Peru would have been 92, 93 because it was a split job. And then Bogota, Colombia was the end of, so no, sorry, May of 03 to the end of 05. So is there 2.5 years?
Sure. Okay. Yeah, interesting. It's certainly challenging times in those parts of the world. But hey, if it wasn't for those parts of the world, then you don't get to do those kinds of jobs, right?
Right. And for me, having been in that field and feeling like I got the best training in the world, I felt that like the more dangerous, the better, because what else was I trained to do if I wasn't going to put those skills to test?
Yeah. If not me, then who, right? It's that.
Right, kinda.
Yeah, they can get someone untrained or lightly trained, or they can get someone who's been trained by the best in the world to, protect the most protected people in the world. So why not? That's a really it's really cool. There's a lot of things I want to pull upon, but let's start at the beginning. So I obviously I've read your book, so I kind of have some spoilers in my head, but I'll try not to let them out.
Sure.
Talk to me about this decision to join the Secret Service and also what, I mean, the time frame, there weren't a lot of female Secret Service agents. What was that process like for you?
Yeah, hell.
Yeah.
I mean, it is. And even, and again, technology has made it much simpler for people. I mean, like, first of all, my writing just sucks. And so filling out forms, like, sometimes they'd be like, I can't even read this, so I'd start all over again. And it was like, you didn't ha even if you typed it, you might have to, and even back then you didn't type a lot, you did a lot hand printing. And so the process is quite long. The thing that happened for me and my decision to go into the Secret Service was I had taken this course as I was a junior in high school, and it was an elective, and it was called criminal law. And I remember one day he was talking about all these different levels of law enforcement, and I was like, oh my God, I know what I'm going to do with my life. I was like, holy cow. So I went home that day, told my parents I was going to work for the FBI. And they were like, okay, great. I'm sure they were probably thinking, yeah. But then I did end up going to study criminal justice in college. And when I graduated college, I went and lived in Seville, Spain. I had told my parents, I had studied a semester on my junior year over there. And I was like, I really loved it, but I want to be more bilingual. So when I graduate, I said, I'm just going to spend a summer. I want to be more bilingual. And I ended up spending 3 more years. So after those 3 years, I came back to the US and I applied to both the Drug Enforcement Agency and the Secret Service. And I really would have gone with whoever hired me first. And it just so happened to be the Secret Service. And that process, even though they told me at the time, both of them, that to expect almost 2 years wait because I had lived overseas and I had traveled to quite a few countries and they wanted to make sure that I wasn't like, a drug runner or an arms dealer or whatever else, could have happened to expect that wait. And I was like, sure. So I got this job and I'm working in Washington, D.C. And I'm coming back from a mission in El Salvador. And I'm going to spend the weekend in Miami. And I call my office back before beepers and cell phones. And so I called my office, say, hey, any messages? And they're like, oh, yes, agent so-and-so called you from the Secret Service. And I'm thinking, oh God, what next? What hoop do they want me to jump through next? And the guy answers the phone and I don't remember his name, but he's like, hey, this is agent suchity such. And I was like, hi. And he starts howling and he goes, well, I'm calling you today to offer you a job as a special agent with the United States Secret Service. And I was like, holy shit, because it was only about 8.5, 9 months. And if I were to look back at that, being a realist, one, I'm a female, I was a little bit older, I was a female. And you had brought that up, that there weren't a lot. At the time, we had 2,000 agents and 9% were women. So about 180 of us. And I also am at the time, and more so then than now, or maybe about the same, I was bilingual. And so that was really appealing. And I would say language in general is appealing for federal law enforcement or any type of law enforcement. So I think they really sped my application through. And so that was it's not a fun process because it's very demanding. There's a lot of interviews and paperwork and polygraph and more interviews and more paperwork and then the background. And like I said, I'm pretty realistic about what happened with my application because I probably should have waited a lot longer.
Mm. So what was that training period like? I mean, I imagine that the era we're talking in, there probably was a little bit less political correctness and for sure. A little bit more hazing and testing than what might be acceptable.
Yeah. So I applied in 1990 and started in 91. So this was George Bush Sr. Yep. I had a lot. I mean, not a lot. I had some push, like even one of my colleagues, when I was going through training with, so we were contemporaries. One day he just looks at me. We're down at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, which is in a town called Glencoe, Georgia. And this is the first, we have two phases of training. We have the first phase where a lot of agencies train, and that's considered criminal investigative training. And then we have the second phase, which is in Washington, D.C., only Secret Service, only things we need to know as Secret Service agents. But in this first phase, this one guy just one day looks at me and he goes, with his face, he's like, what are you even doing here? Why don't you just go home? And I was like, I just started laughing. And it pissed him off even more, which was like, I guess, the desired effect. And, you know, I can only imagine that I pissed him off or intimidated him, or like nothing fazed me. I thought training was fun. I thought our stupid blue uniforms were fun. I thought eating in the cafeteria was fun. I was like, they're paying me to do all this, you know, and he just did not, you know. And I had other colleagues that did not think women belonged. And, you know, they used to have this saying, Broads, Buicks, and Booze, you know, why did you guys mess it up? You know, because the Buicks were the typical government ride that we got. And one guy said that to me once in a command post, and he goes, you guys really kind of messed it up. I go, gosh, it kind of seems like the best decision that the service made. And he just starts laughing, you know. And the secret for me, and for other, you know, one other really close female friend that I had that was an agent, was do your flipping job. Don't whine about, you know, what you're not getting as far as missions or jobs as a female, but earn the respect by just doing the job. I would also say that what really helped me, particularly during training, that earned me respect was I was a really good athlete. You know, we'd have days down in Georgia that were humid as hell, and they'd have these heat warnings where we weren't allowed to run outside. And so we'd have to do our mandatory physical training inside. And so we'd do that, and I'd say, okay, are we done? And he's like, yeah. I go, okay, I'm gonna go for a run. And they'd look at me like, what? He goes, hot as hell. It's like, for me, the hotter, the better, the more I sweat, the better. I love it, I still do. I'm one of those weird people that loves humidity, but it was one of those things where I think people were like, okay, she's a female, but you know, and quite frankly, they're always waiting for us to screw up. But that's the type of competition and demand I thrive on. Tell me I can't, I'll show you I can, and I'll do it really well, and I'll do it better than you.
Mm-hmm. Now, I won't spoil the exit party from the Secret Service, but I am curious about the decision to basically continue your career and to go to some places that are not very hospitable. How is that process in terms of getting into that? I mean, it's kind of quasi PMC work in a lot of ways, but also mm-hmm. like just that executive protection world at the time as a female, all those considerations. Obviously, coming out of the Secret Service is that's a pretty marketable thing to have on your CV.
Yeah.
But how was that process for you?
Yeah. You know, my very first job, which was out of the Secret Service in private protection, was in Lima, Peru. And it came as a reference from somebody I knew back in the days when I was working the job as my Secret Service and DEA applications were being processed. And very chauvinistic country. And the protectee interviewed me before I was chosen, and he got up from the interview and he just said, there's no protection like the protection of a woman. Hire this girl. And what I think he realized, and what I say all the time to people, is like, you can whine about all the negatives about being a female in law enforcement, but first of all, it's still a male dominated world. So don't expect your butt to be kissed, or don't expect rose petals and the red carpet. Like, I barged my way into a male dominated industry, and I loved it, and I loved the challenge. And there's bullshit in every industry that you're in. So big deal. You don't think I belong there. Well, I'll prove to you that I do. And so in this case, somebody, like, I've had people say to me, oh, I can't believe that you weren't offended and you read it in the book every day, and inevitably, oh, you must be the protectee's daughter. You must be the protectee's secretary. You must be the protectee's affair, his lover. Every single time I'd be like, mm-hmm, uh-huh. And people are like, weren't you mad? I go, it doesn't matter what they think who I am. That only gives me a few extra seconds that if things go to shit, I'll be the one that they aren't looking at me to pull out the 9mm and get that guy into the car and get out of here. I'm the last person in a chauvinistic country they're going to be looking to. So for me, all of those whatevers were an advantage. Mm. Those judgments, those misconceptions, whatever, they were to my advantage.
Yeah, I mean, one of the when we get into executive protection, and obviously we don't want to make the show exclusively about executive protection, but it's being low profile is a massive advantage.
Totally.
The days of finding the college football player with a bad knee to be your bodyguard because they're big, like those days are dying, right? Well, they should
be, yeah.
But I mean, they still serve a purpose, right? But there's
some of them still exist, like in Hollywood, and yeah, probably yeah. But because they're dissuasive, right? So. They're intimidating, so
they're good for pushing photographers out of the way.
Exactly.
But really, executive protection, like you don't want to draw a lot of attention. So
correct.
Anything that doesn't look like a classical security detail can be a really big benefit, and especially at the time. I mean, I know that there's a lot more women in the field now than what there would have been, we're talking about 30 years ago.
Sure.
So certainly at the time, it would have been a massive advantage. And not to mention just the places you can go, the things you can get to, the access you can get as a female where you won't be treated as suspiciously as a male.
True.
So there's a lot of interesting things about that. And being bilingual, I guess, is also a huge advantage for
it. Is. It was really amazing. Yeah. And a lot of times because I was American, they didn't expect me to understand or be able to communicate.
Yeah. Yeah. And just intelligence gathering, just the conversations you can overhear that people don't assume you can understand. And those are fun things. One of the drills that I do in training, we did with the UK group quite a bit, was we call predator bingo, which is basically going out into the field and identifying targets. If you were looking for a child to abduct, what child would you choose? If you were looking for a female to rob, which female would you choose? And and this is a real challenge because I hopefully I'm only training people that haven't done this before, it's a challenge because it gets them to think in the mindset of a predator and look at,
totally.
And then you kind of reverse engineer, okay, why does that person stick out? And you can kind of start to see the habits or the things that they're doing that make them vulnerable.
But beautiful.
A part of the question I always put to them is not just who, but how. How would you do it? And would you come back with a team? Would you build it? Would you have a strategy? Like, how would you get to that person? And one of the things that nearly always comes up is, I would work in a team, male and female, because if you have a female, you can get a lot more access. There's a lot more sympathy you can play in. There's the mum who's lost her child, that if any mum comes up to a parent in a park and says, "Oh my God, I've lost my child," there's no parent is going to say, "Get away from me, strange woman," right? So, which causes a distraction, which then makes vulnerabilities and things like that. So
sure.
There's so many things that I think, in our desire to homogenize everything, that there's so many things that we can look at individual strengths, men, women, different experience levels, different age groups. I think there's so much that we should be, rather than lamenting what we don't have, is to look at what are the things I have that others don't.
Sure.
I remember working event security way back at the beginning of my career and noticing that the undercover police officers at a music festival were normally like the first year constables, right? Because they're 20 years
really?
Old, 21 years old, like put them in the crowd and no one notices they're standing next
perfect.
To a police officer.
Yeah.
You put a 35-year-old guy with a buzz cut, Oakleys and a G-Shock watch and it's pretty obvious. play your strengths, I guess. So talk me through, what are some of the learnings that you had, maybe transitioning out of the Secret Service where you are relatively well-resourced, at least compared to the private sector. What are some
of
the things that you had to adapt or you had to learn or things that you reflect upon?
Yeah.
Really good growth moments.
Yeah. Huge, huge, huge learning curve, particularly on that first job. I was working with one other guy to protect this individual who, quite frankly, had an active life, meaning... So we'd split the shift. I was mornings and my colleague who was former Special Forces was evenings because our protectee liked the nightlife. And he was a huge flirt. He constantly hit on me. And he'd be like, "Oh, come on, Maribel," like, because that was my Spanish name. "Don't you want to go out with us tonight? Or why don't you wait in my room when I get home?" And I'd like, in my head, roll my eyes, and then say, yeah, Mari, I'll see you at 7 a.m. for that walk in the morning. You know, he'd always say he's going to get up at 7 a.m. and walk. And of course, about 90% of the time he didn't. But the point is, I had one other person that I was working with. Yes, did we start, as you have, I'm sure have used it, you get super resourceful. When you go from having all the resources of the Secret Service and you don't, yes, you hear no sometimes, you might 20 people and they only give you 15. But, you know, you also have field office people, you have equipment left and right, up and down. We had next to nothing. And I actually really enjoyed, again, the challenge of going, okay, so who can we trust, or who can we maybe use for different things? You know, we learned that we really couldn't trust the local police. Sometimes you'd use a hotel person to hold an elevator, like whatever. You just hope it's going to work out. It doesn't always work out. But I really realized that, you know, I became such a clever and resourceful person because I didn't have a chance. In the past, when I was a Secret Service agent, everything was just given to you. You just assumed that's how it worked. And so, you know, and then every mission was very different as far as equipment, as far as, you know, even attire. Haiti, we were wearing khakis and just like, you know, those sort of photographer vests because it was so stinking hot. We just wanted our weapons covered. And here in Peru, it varied, sometimes more dressy, depending on what he was doing. In Colombia, it also varied. And even with the wealthy families I protected, it really depended on what they were doing. So, you know, the resources so varied, and the, I think my personality is such that I really have the gift of gab. Thank you, Mom and Dad. And so I am one of those people that, you know, worked sort of, like you said, close to like the PMC style of government contract. But then I could be with a family that had little kids and do great. And I remember one father who was the chairman and CEO of a cosmetics company said to me, like, you know, what kind of has a secret, like, you treat my family so nicely and we aren't, oh, you know, we haven't always had this experience. And I said, well, I just think, how would I want my mother to be treated, or how would I want to be treated if my life was such that all of a sudden I needed 24/7 people knowing everything about my life? And it's just so invasive. And so that's kind of how I looked at it. But also with keeping that, as you know, the protectee is not your friend. So keeping that sort of barrier in the middle of like, there's only so far I'll go type kind of thing, which can get tricky, as you know.
Absolutely. Especially if you're embedded with someone's family, to not get attached to the kids or not get attached to someone that you think is just a good person in a bad situation. And
sure,
those are really tricky circumstances to navigate.
For sure.
Yeah. I like what you said there about it. You like the challenge of the lack of resources, because it is something that I always chuckle at when I see someone that's come from a relatively well-resourced field, whether it's private or government or wherever, but where they've had access to a lot of resources and they get to a less resourced position and they kind of just throw their hands in the air and go, well, this is impossible. So, well, it's not impossible. We're doing it. Stop thinking it's impossible and instead reframe it and say, if it was possible, what would it look like? Like, how would you make it work?
Amen.
Because there's no point saying it's not possible. If we're doing it anyway, like, that's not going to help. So
And you know, I so appreciate your mentality, because the reframing, I mean, you know, in the world of psychology that I work in now, I'm big into cognitive behavioral theory, which always talks about, you know, resilience. I see your pre-resilience there. And reframing and choosing the lens through which you look. And I think that for me, one of my mottos has always and will always be, never let him see you sweat. So do you think for 1 second I was ever going to say, like, I can't do this job because I don't have X, Y, and Z? And they'd say, oh, it's because she's a girl.
Yeah.
Right. And there was no way. So it was, if it killed me, I was going to figure out a way.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I like it. Let's talk about that psychology side. So obviously it's something you always had an interest in because you did your undergrad, and then 10 years later decided you're up for more pain. And then 15 years later you want to go and do a doctorate. I don't know if I'll ever get to a doctorate. I feel like it's...
Those were interesting circumstances. I started at 43 years old, so it was hell.
I can't imagine just being interested in one topic for that long. Let's talk through that, because I know you worked as a counselor as well. Yeah.
I still do. I'm still a therapist.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. You're still a therapist. So that's a transition, right? I mean, I always found that when you work in protection, you're always part therapist anyway.
Yeah.
But
true.
What made you want to make that shift? And I'm just curious about the complications of being sort of part protector, suck it up, princess, get on with it, and part,
yeah,
just like, how does that work?
I know, where does the empathy come in? Because I can tell you that some of my former colleagues were like, what, you're becoming and I do wonder, like, I just think I have two different sides. It's not that sometimes I don't think that, like, about myself or about people around me, but then if someone asks me from a psychological perspective, I do have the empathy. And I, but what, when I first went into the field, it was because I had the Haiti experience, and I left that mission a little bit, I'll be really honest, I was a little bit sort of bitter. I was working with 10 men and me in a country where there was no social life. Like, in other words, every other shithole I worked in, you know, Colombia wasn't a shithole, but a lot of people think it is. But even in Lima, that wasn't so fancy or whatever, I still could go to the restaurants. I could go out for coffee. I went running. I mean, the water was close by. I had a life, you know, albeit by myself. It's not like I had friends in Colombia. I had friends. But there, you know, anybody that's listening or even has an idea of what Haiti is like, it wasn't, you didn't, there were a few restaurants that you went to, but not by myself. And I wasn't loving too many of my teammates. There was a lot of boozing, a lot of whoring, a lot of married guys that were whoring. And I got really just sort of burnt out. And I was like, okay, you're coming into the office, you're shaking because you're lacking alcohol and you're supposed to cover my six?
Yeah.
Fuck that, excuse my French. But, like, you know, I just was like, after 8.5 months, I was like, I gotta get out of here. And it's time to go back to graduate school, just time. And so that was timing. And then my doctorate was, if you'll allow me to tell the story, I was living in San Diego, California, which was heaven. I mean, it's like beautiful. And I met my now husband. So I didn't get married till, again, like right around when I started graduate school, I was almost 43. And I moved to the East Coast for him, because that's where his daughter was and she came to live with us. And so I moved to a part of the country I did not want to live in. And I was like, I'm giving up my part in a security company, my position. And so watch my face here. And the place, like, that was ideal for me to live for a man, like, what the heck, right? I mean, think about it again. I'm 41 at the time, 42. And I'm like, I was super independent. I mean, the only thing that ever depended on me was my cat, you know, and I was doing all this for a guy. And so I was like, I'm going to do something for me. And so that's what really pushed me for the doctorate. I don't know if anything else in life would have had me make that commitment. It was like a glutton for punishment. And I agree with you. 5 years was hell.
Yeah.
It's
a big step.
Yeah.
I would love to know more about your decision going to forensic psychology, because I know you did your master's in forensic psychology, your doctorate in clinical psychology.
Yes.
Where does your passion lie when it comes to psychology?
The more effed up the brain, the better. you know, I mean, when I studied forensic psychology, I really studied the minds of criminals so that I could help those that have been victimized, right? So I've worked with all sorts of people, but right after that, right after my master's, I worked with victims of stalking and domestic violence. But 2 years later, 9/11 happened and I got back into the security field. So now, being back for, you know, about 10, 12 years now back in clinical and forensic psychology, I do love, like, I'm such a fortunate person. My life just sort of works out, but I was teaching at the college level at a university in Washington, D.C. called the George Washington University. And I made a proposal that they made happen. I said, I'm teaching abnormal psychology for you guys, but will you let me teach this course that I want to create called the Psychology of Crime and Violence? And they're like, well, we usually don't do that for people who are adjuncts because, you know, we don't want it to turn into an orphan course. And I was like, yeah, I get it. Next thing I know, he writes me, he's like, hey, how about in the fall? And I was like, hell yeah. Like, it was amazing. And so I taught that. Because of COVID, I ended up teaching it three times. I was only supposed to teach it once, but then COVID happened and I got three bonus semesters teaching virtually. So I taught that, and it was completely self-created. So it was all really forensic related. Like, the very first thing I had my students read was the chapter of this book. I think it's called Whoever Fights Monsters, and it's called The Vampire Killer. And it's about a guy, and it was just like a bunch of like this guy, they call him the vampire killer because when you got to the crime scene, there were blenders and yogurt cups full of blood because this individual had schizophrenia. And he believed that if he didn't drink the blood of his victims, which is why he was creating victims, he needed their blood, he was going to die of some like something chalk disease. Okay. So that's where his brain was. And I just said to my students, if you can't handle this chapter, can you please leave the class? Because there's 40 people on the wait list. So I kind of like started it off with a little bit of gore and grossness. Like a lot of it was that, like a lot of my students would say to me, I loved the material, but I couldn't read it or watch it at night. And I was like, okay. So that's sort of like, I will always and forever have a passion for that side of things to really understand the criminal brain and help people understand the criminal brain to help protect them against that and to help them help other victims. And that's true also of law enforcement, is understanding what you might see on the street. Right?
Yeah, I find that area really fascinating myself, because I think there's, we tend to, even people that are in this field that, want to understand the psychology of violence, they'll dive really deeply into a very small percentage of people. Like they'll go really exhaustive on serial killers. As an example, because there's a lot of literature about it, because it's Hollywood friendly, right? A serial killer is always going to be a cool story from an entertainment point of view and from a, you know, getting clicks. But then there's just the psychology of everyday violence. You know, what makes someone an abuser? What makes someone more prone to social violence than someone else? What are the impacts of trauma on someone as a child, or as a, you know, generational trauma on their decisions to act violently? What's the impact of culture on their decisions to act violently?
True.
There's so many pieces to that that are really fascinating. And I think we sometimes overemphasize the dramatic when there's probably more benefit to be had in really understanding the more banal violence that we just walk past.
That you might encounter yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're very unlikely to ever meet a serial killer unless you happen to work in a field where you go looking for them.
Right.
So, yeah, and even then, you're like, I'm going to go catch serial killers. Like, oh, you've just been 30 years of a career in law enforcement and never had one, right?
Right.
That's really interesting. And just talking about the different types of violent psychology. What are some of the, as you started getting into the research there, I mean, obviously you had your own practical experience, your own sort of, I guess, what we say, casual research along the ways, as we always do when you're interested
sure.
in the subject.
Yeah.
But as you got deeper into the academic side, were there any sort of aha moments for you, or things that you weren't expecting to be really interesting but were?
You know, I mean, much like my students and like anybody that takes a class with me, you know, I could now diagnose every protectee I worked for, half my teammates. You know, you kind of wish you would have had the, I don't know. It seems sometimes that I did it in reverse order. And other times I'm like, no, I don't know, because which one informed the next? Like, did my law enforcement inform my psychology, or would my psychology have informed my law enforcement? I think either way was fine, but sometimes I feel like I went in reverse order. And the fact is, in a way, I did it right, because, you know, being 56, still doing private protection is not the easiest on the body. Mm-hmm. So doing trainings, I still do a little bit of consulting, well, quite a bit of consulting in the field, the security field. But more focused on people and keeping them mentally healthy, which I think is very intertwined with physically healthy. You know, I look at it as the umbrella of health, mental, physical, emotional. And what some people will say is, I'm actually stealing this from somebody that says to me, he goes, oh, you became, you went from being a protector of people to a protector of emotions. Like, people, you're still protecting people, but now it's not because they're physically in danger, it's because they're mentally in danger. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I am going to steal that. And I'm using that, you know, and I think it's true, because I am a protector of people, and people's mental health can make or break a life.
Yeah.
When you think about it, particularly what's happened over the past couple of years, which we don't need to get into, but it has either exacerbated quite a few people's already existing either symptoms or diagnosis, or it's created lots of new stuff that long term we'll see what happens.
Yeah, absolutely. I think just being able to have that introspective lens, and I want to get into what you teach in your webinars as we get towards the end, because I think that's a really cool conversation to have as well. But
thank you.
So much for me of self-defense or self-protection or keeping safe from violence or whatever you want to call it, I use the label violence prevention and management now, because I feel like it's clunky but it's accurate. So okay. But
yeah,
But when you're looking at that, so much of it is understand your own self first. Like, understand the situations you put yourself in, understand your own desires, understand the situations that you manifest, because secretly you kind of like the conflict. Secretly you kind of like that kind of relationship. Secretly you kind of like some part of you is seeking that that dysfunctional thing. But when I teach young men, like young men are the prime audience for self-defense training, because they really just like... Sure. They're more prone to get into social violence. They want to learn how to defend themselves. It's a macho thing, mm-hmm. right? And that's pretty much who I started off teaching. And one of my former guests, good friend Mary Stevens, she said that the problem with the self-defense industry is that it's like four bouncers by bouncers. I'm like, yeah, I kind of get it, because that was me, right? I was a young bouncer teaching other young men how to
yep.
defend themselves when they get into an inevitably stupid fight outside a nightclub. And I used to look at that, and I taught them all physical skills. Now, if I have someone who's a young man, especially like early 20s, mid 20s, I'd say, okay, let's have a look at your own psychology. Like, why do you keep getting into fights? I remember having a student once who's like 22 years old. And he said to me, every time I go out, I get into a fight. Someone's always trying to pick on me. It's because I'm little. It's like, no, it's because you're obnoxious.
Thank you.
Actually, you are the most punchable person I know. Like, you're paying me and I want to hit you.
That's awesome.
But like, he just was such an obnoxious individual. And I can only imagine what he was like when he was drunk. And he had no awareness of the fact that he was bringing this upon himself. He thought he was just being victimized because he was a little guy. He's like, no, it's because you're...
Was he able to see that when you said that to him?
No, not at the time. No. I think he kind of just, he laughed it off. Like I was making a joke, and I was like, no, okay.
Oh, you're not really
bad. But, yeah, hopefully he figured it out before anything too bad happened to him. It's like one of those guys that always make the joke that, you know, there's some people you never want to wish violence upon anybody, but when violence does happen to someone, you're not overly surprised by it. You're like, okay, that makes sense. Throwing through a window. It's only a matter of time. Anyway, I digress.
I love it.
But
not at all.
But certainly when it comes to understanding your own victim profile and threat packaging, mm-hmm. and understanding threat assessment, I mean, this is something that if you come from a protection world or from a security world, it's like step one, right? Is understand where you're vulnerable and understand mm-hmm. who might be trying to hurt you, why they'd be trying to hurt you, how they might get there, what the threat vectors might be. Like, those are the things that we look at from a security point of view 101. But I mm-hmm. think that there's a lot of value to be had in understanding that for yourself as well. And you're having that little bit of self-awareness of how do I project myself? Project my own sort of personality. What are my environments? What are my relationships? Do I take unnecessary risk? And if I do take unnecessary risk, that's not necessarily, it's not saying, well, you can't take risk, because that would be a silly way to live your life. But
yes,
am I aware of when I'm taking a risk and what extra precautions I can take to make that as safe as possible?
Right.
I've got four daughters, right? So that's, for me, it's like, it's not about,
God bless.
It's not about them not taking risks. It's about them being aware of when they're taking a risk and making sure that they've thought it through and they're understanding the reality around them. Right. Let's talk a little bit about what you teach from, in your webinars. I know you've just recently done a couple on self-awareness and self-defense.
Well, you just mentioned Mary Stevens. She came to my most current webinar, which was, you know, about what you were just saying. I said you could have been a guest speaker at my workshop, which was about self-awareness and self-defense. And it was about knowing your mental and physical strengths and weaknesses, and not just taking weaknesses and working on them, but also recognizing that your strengths need to be nurtured. You can't just assume that your self-defense skills, for example, are going to show up if you haven't practiced them in 5 or 10 years, right? So, in all the workshops I do so far anyway, I've done two, and I'm doing another one this month because it's Mental Health Awareness Month, and this one will be free. So this will be like a lunchtime sort of hour webinar, versus the workshops are interactive.
Sure.
Like, I ask them to participate and we put things in the chat box and stuff. But the first one was on resilience. And so what happens is afterwards, there's always a challenge. And in this case, there's four different challenges, one each week for them to work on. So the first one last week, which was the first follow-up email, was them working on finding their voice. So if you're walking down the street and you are creeped out by somebody, typically speaking, a woman gets embarrassed about, you know, screaming stop or F you or leave me alone or whatever. And so is practicing that and like putting up your hand. And then this week with three different attached videos is practice, just learn one self-defense skill. Just learn one. Learn, you know, and you got to practice it. Like, you don't want to go kicking your husband in the crotch, but you want to be able to practice it where it's realistic and you know what it feels like from your end and their end, right? I mean, not everybody has the opportunity to go into a gym and kick somebody in a full red suit, right? But some people have really gotten into it. And so I asked them also to communicate with me, like, how's it going? Whatever. And like in the first workshop I did on resilience, I had them do a 30-day challenge to become more resilient. And I had them communicate with me. And it's like, okay, even if week one is done and you haven't even created your challenge, let's work on it together. Like, you know, because you can't just think, I have a magic wand and I'm going to make you more resilient or I'm going to make you more self-aware. It takes work, you know, but it's really a lot of the basis is what you and I were talking about is that whole cognitive behavioral theory. The foundation is, you know, what we're thinking kind of translates to how we feel. And it just totally determines how we live our life and vice versa. How we live our life affects how we think, how we feel, et cetera. They're all intertwined. And the beautiful thing is, if you look at it this way, is, wow, you mean I have control over that? Mm-hmm. And other people go, oh, F that. Like, I don't want to have control over that. I just want somebody to fix me. And it's like, kind of takes some work, right?
I love that about control. This has been my retort over the last couple of years. Whenever I get accused of victim blaming by telling someone that, you know, there are ways we can prevent bad things from happening. Oh, you're victim blaming. It's like, no, I'm victim empowering.
The opposite. Yeah.
Like, bad stuff will happen. There are bad people out there. And if they do bad things, that's exclusively on them. However, there are things you can do to make sure they don't happen to you. Right. And that's, I fail to see how that's a bad thing to be able to teach people that, other than we just pick up the sand and pretend that bad things don't happen. And if they do happen, it's a horrible thing and you get to be a victim. Right. It's like, well, you don't want to be a victim. So you don't want
that's not a good plan. Doing nothing is not a good plan. Thinking somebody else is going to rescue you or defend you is not a good plan. Having hope is not a good plan.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think there's so much to be had there. I'm curious from the workshops you've done, from the research you've done, understanding the psychology of criminals, also the psychology of victims. Like, are there common traits that you identify for someone who's a bit habitually involved in violence, whether it's social violence finds them, whether it's getting themselves into the repeated pattern of abusive relationships? Like, are there things that you identify there as common traits?
Low self-esteem.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting, as you were saying that, I'm like, oh gosh, I'm not sure. Like, I was thinking, like, there isn't a profile, but like, what am I going to say? And that came to me because it is, in fact, I mean, it's the truth in that it's the ones that don't think they can defend themselves or don't think that people like them, that don't think, so they tend to put themselves in situations to either try to belong, to placate, to be liked, et cetera. And that can lead to serial victimization unless they do the work to, one, identify that they have low self-esteem, and then two, to work on it, because it can totally be worked on. Apologies. Yeah, so it's actually, believe it or not, that was the basis of my whole doctoral dissertation. So identifying that in this age group of women, low self-esteem is an issue, and it leads to a lot of both mental and physical issues. And then so increasing it, that's the solution. And so increasing self-esteem in young women was the whole basis of my doctoral dissertation. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the basis of the work I do now, I'm into women's empowerment, which, by the way, to your listeners, does not mean anti-man. I'm very pro-man. And I loved working in a very male-dominated world. And, you know, I ended up marrying a total stud. He's a former Navy SEAL. And, you know, it's not that. It's just recognizing that and it's just a fact, it's not an insult, that we are the weaker sex when it comes to defending ourselves, you know, in general. There are some women that are amazing, okay? And some guys that aren't so great, you know, whatever. But I'm just saying that, like, why not up it a little bit? Why not increase our resilience? Why not up our self-esteem? Why not, why not, why not? And just working on these things to empower women to be happier and live more fulfilling lives.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better. And we could go on a whole different tangent about the effect of trauma and cultural significance and and what leads to that self-esteem, that low self-esteem, and how you rehabilitate.
Yeah.
Someone has lived that way for 30 years, but
yeah,
it is, it's fascinating. I think it's something that we really need to be more proactive about, rather than just trying to fix broken people. How do we stop people getting broken in the first place? And how do you stop them having those 20 or 30 years of terrible traumatic experiences before they reach a therapist who actually unpacks this for them and helps them, you know, change their ways?
Well,
there's also
How about parents that give a shit about their kids and that they have them not as something to stick on the shelf, but like you saying, like, I have four daughters, I've got to kind of prepare them for what the world looks like. And that matters. Like, yeah, that's already a recipe. That's already a success formula.
Yeah, well, I'm already under-resourced to protect them, right? I'm outnumbered. So I've got to
send them my way.
Yeah, I'd love to. You feel free to take them for as long as you want.
oh my God, that's funny.
There's also, I think there's people that live around violence, they live around crime, they live around that chaos. They sometimes get comfortable in that environment and they feel scared if they're not. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the work of Rory Miller. Rory worked in corrections for a long time, and he's written some really great books around his observations on violence in the correction environment. And just like people thrive in a certain environment, and when they're pulled from that environment, it feels they're uncomfortable. It's like they can't make peace with peace. Like it doesn't feel good.
Right.
Funnily enough, one of my favorite bands, US band called Hailstorm, female led rock band, really, really cool, fun band. And one of their most popular songs is called I Miss the Misery. And I was listening to it, and while I was writing something, I was doing some research, and I was listening to this music in the background. And I was like, man, if Daddy Issues was a song, it would be this song.
You could write it and become famous. Yeah, like, I was listening. Have Taylor Swift sing it.
Yeah, this is this, like, you know, I miss, basically the whole song is like, I don't miss you, but I miss the fighting, and I miss the conflict, and I miss the misery, and I miss the unpredictability, and I miss the chaos.
Yeah.
It's like this, like, weird sort of messed up,
the devil, you know. And that's, yeah, I think sometimes why women end up in serial abusive relationships. It's like, I know that's not healthy, but I don't know how to deal with that.
Yeah.
Which is that, like, non-fighting, non-being, you know, abused, whether that be physical, mental, etc. So
I don't have any skills for how to manage that normal life. It's
totally,
that's not what they've been, you know, raised for in a lot of ways, which is kind of sad.
Yep.
So what's next for you? I mean, we're heading towards the end of the normal interview. So I'd like to, yeah, what are you working on now? What's the next chapter look like in this highly unpredictable career of yours?
Yeah. I get bored really easily in my life career. I don't know, because I'm not teaching, because COVID hit, and I decided this past semester was my last semester. I did not teach. And I was like, I really need to work on, you know, kind of getting the word out about my book and the messages with my book. And obviously that's, you know, why I'm here. Will I ever write the second book? And I'll explain. When I sat down to write this book, The Protector, I thought I'd write my whole story. And it ended up being so many pages just on my life as a protection agent that it became its own book. I thought I would also get the private investigations in there as well. And I don't know, you know, again, you have some law enforcement in your audience. It, to me, my private investigations are actually more interesting than my protection field. It's just that I'm more unique in the protection field because I'm a female. You know, there are, I'm really not anymore the type of investigator that you didn't know I was investigating you. So I never, with the exception of one, now forget the Secret Service. I always, you know, had my badge and I had to identify myself. But when I went into the private sector, there was only one investigation I did when I was working for the new show 60 Minutes. They demanded that I say who I was and what I was doing. And I was like, oh, bummer, because I can get way more information otherwise. But, you know, I got put on a plane to talk to somebody. I lived in a house to observe people. I did all sorts of stuff that, like, made me paranoid.
Yeah.
You know? And I really, really enjoyed that. So I'm not sure whether I'll ever write that. I will continue to do workshops. I'll continue to, I do therapy. I do mental health trainings. I consult. And like right now, it's kind of like, aha, now that the world's opening, I would love to do some, like, you know, book signings, but, you know, that's maybe in the fall if things really stay open, right? If they're continuing to do those events. So it's really kind of like a I don't know answer. I don't feel like I have any set path, you know, and I'm not ready to retire, and I may never be ready to retire. You know, I'm 56. I have a lot of years of life in me. I also spent a lot of years in school, so I feel like I got to use all that time and money and those gifts that I have to help people. I have as many paying clients as I do pro bono clients, to be frank. I have one pro bono client. I am on session number 109, I think.
Wow.
So we've been working together for a couple of years, and it was not the original expectation, but it was, I don't want to give too much information, but it was an evolving thing that some extra trauma was created throughout that we thought, because we thought that this case that she was involved in, which was part of the reason she came to me, was going to be over long before it was.
Sure.
So now it's like that transition into the world from the government. Yeah.
I think the not planning things too far in advance has worked fairly well for you so far. So
yeah.
I look forward to following you and seeing what comes next. And
thank
I do
you.
Hope you write the other book, because as I said, guys, and this isn't just because Mary Beth is on the podcast, but I reached out because the book was such a good read. So
thank you.
I didn't read the book because I wanted to interview you. I read the book first and then I reach out. So
thank you.
Yeah. It's a fantastic book. It's really well written. Not just interesting, it's actually really well written. So
I had great editors. So I'm not like this great author. I just had a story to tell. I had great editors.
If it keeps the same editors, the next book will be good as well.
Oh yeah. So. No, I would. I would even if they double their prices, I would.
Mary Beth, just to close, if people want to find out more about you, where can they go to learn more about you?
Yeah, I have a website, and it's drmarybeth.com. So it's drmarybeth, MARYBETH.com. And you can find my book on there. You can find my book on Amazon. You can find my book in a lot of places. And on my website, you can contact me. It's my email is mb, like Mary Beth, mb@drmarybeth.com. So you can do that or just find me on my website. So yeah, and you can find anything you want about me, I think, at this point on the website or on the net. So the irony, right, of living in the shadows and then just being all over the place.
I know. It's something that I'm like, my instinct is like, I just kind of want to be a gray man. It's like, no, we can't do business that way.
I know. Yeah, it is the tough part. If I could get off all social media, I'd be doing cartwheels.
All right. Well, I know you're going to stick around and do some bonus content for our Patreon contributors.
Sure.
For those leaving us here, thank you very much, Dr. Mary Beth Jenke.
Thank you.
Thank you once again to Dr. Mary Beth Jenke. Make sure you pick up her book, The Protector. It's a fantastic read, as I said. And of course, if you want to grab bonus content from this episode and all our other episodes, go to patreon.com/managing violence. Check out our website at violencepod.com. And if you're interested in workplace violence prevention in Australia or elsewhere, go to www.risk2solution.com. Until next time, stay safe and stay dangerous.